The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by the Sympathizer podcast from HBO. From executive producers Park Chan-wook and Robert Downey Jr., The Sympathizer is the new HBO original limited series based on the Pulitzer Prize-winning novel of the same name. On The Sympathizer podcast, join host Philip Nguyen in conversation with the cast, crew, and author Viet Thanh Nguyen as they discuss the making of this historic series. Stream new episodes of HBO's The Sympathizer, Sundays exclusively on Max, and listen to The Sympathizer podcast wherever you listen to podcasts.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive. Are you driving your car or doing laundry right now? Podcasts go best when they're bundled with another activity. Like Progressive home and auto policies, they're best when they're bundled too. Having these two policies together makes insurance easier and could help you save. Customers who save by switching their home and car insurance to Progressive save nearly $800 on average. Quote a home and car bundle today at Progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $793 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2021 and May 2022. Potential savings will vary.
Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Some of you may be familiar with a novelist called Arthur Less, a minor American novelist, to be precise. He's the hero of Andrew Sean Greer's novel called Less. He's a man whose biggest talent seems to be taking a problem and making it five times worse. Less was a bestseller and won the Pulitzer Prize for fiction, which is pretty rare for a book as funny as Less. In Andrew Sean Greer's sequel, Less is Lost, Arthur Less has now fallen on hard times, and so he takes on a series of gigs to make ends meet, which turns into a kind of road trip across the United States.
It was right after the 2016 presidential election, and I just thought, oh, there's something I don't understand. Let me go right into that, because my family is from the South, and I thought, I don't understand where my family's from. Apparently, the challenge was this time not how to write joy on the page, but to how to write about my country, honestly. That was what was constantly in my mind.
Andrew Sean Greer just talked with our staff writer, Parle Sagel.
One of the things I love about talking about Less and Less is Lost with other readers is this shy expression kind of takes over their faces and they'll just say how much they enjoyed it, as if pleasure is this subversive feeling that we've forgotten we can get this from literary fiction. But I, you know, as I was reading this, I was like, why don't I read more books like this? Why do I laugh so infrequently when I'm reading this? What is it about the comic novel? Why don't we see more of them? Why do they feel so rare?
I mean, that's a tough question because when people ask me my influences, I end up saying, like, actually, I only have a couple comic novels that I really love. And I thought I needed to be a serious writer. It's a sin. You know, it's sinful. We're supposed to be learning something important through serious thought, not through someone's manipulation of our sense of humor and taking us across it. And yet I know that some of my favorite books, the ones I hold dear and reread, are like Graham Greene's Entertainments. I don't reread his colonial adventure books. I reread Travels with My Aunt.
Yeah, I think that's right. And we also have to be conscious of ourselves as learning. And it's such a shame because, you know, when I think about the comic novel and the comic novel as you are writing them, you know, they're a fantastic cover. Charm is a terrific cover for all kinds of things that one can do and that you are up to, you know? And one of the things that struck me as I was reading Less is Lost is how interested he becomes in his journey in his own whiteness. And it becomes a book about whiteness, which I don't think I've seen reviews pick up on, in fact.
I thought a lot about it. Like, okay, I'm writing a book about like a white gay guy going through the South. What I don't want to have is the road trip story where he goes to like a black church and comes to understanding about race. Like, that's wildly offensive. What I'm going to do is treat each side person as a real person. You can't just have someone walk in and pour coffee and walk out and that they only have like a beehive hairdo and funny glasses. Like, that's not moral, you know, like in some strange way. I was like, that you have to spend time to make that a real person.
I mean, to go to the idea of comedy and charm sort of being they can be a bit of a cover. I was thinking about, you know, you're following up your Pulitzer Prize winning book Less with Less is Lost. And there's so much to enjoy and love about these books that are about love, but they're also, you know, positioning themselves as a story about America, you know. I want to hear you talk a little bit more about that and more about what the novel can do when you're thinking about telling the story of a country, you know, that maybe an article can't do or an essay or a nonfiction book. Where can the novel take us?
Well, that was the challenge, is how do you talk about something so big and amorphous and that's changing underneath your feet? And luckily, I think a novelist can bring it to you, can first of all not answer it. And I feel like an article sometimes feels they have to come up with a thesis about it. I have a sort of Czech writer show up at the beginning of the book and say, Americans never ask themselves, what if the whole idea is wrong? And we don't. We just keep saying, how can we fix this? But what if it was a flawed from the beginning? And I don't have an answer to that. I just wanted to think about it as I did my trip and as I wrote about my trip and see whether a gay man could feel at home in these places where he's not supposed to be, whether anyone really feels at home in a country that's so vast. You surely feel out of home somewhere. And yeah. How we're going to hold together, which was also about the relationship between Arthur and Freddie, our narrator, whether they can hold together.
I think that notion of how to persist without answers is so central to the book, both in the sense of, you know, the American experiment, but also, I mean, this is profoundly a book about middle age and, right, and about this relationship whose code word is uncertain and uncertainty,
yeah.
Right? So how do you persist without scripts and without answers? And I think this brings me to some of the scenes that I found most moving in this book that I feel like I actually haven't seen. I'm sure they exist elsewhere in novels, but I certainly haven't seen them enough. And that's conversations between different generations of gay men. And that, to me, I was like, this is different, right? Because there's, you know, Freddie's of a certain age, Arthur's a bit older, and then there's Arthur's lover who's passed away. And you see three different lives or three different sets of questions, three different sets of fears, anxieties. Tell me about staging these kinds of conversations and this kind of relationship. Was it a conscious,
well, it was
a conscious aim?
That was the setup that I got to bring with me from Les, because it interested me to have a character who'd been the younger lover suddenly get older and become the older lover. And then I realized I had set up three different generations of gay men, and I am very aware of those completely different approaches to life. I hear my generation of men in their around 50 expressing displeasure at watching younger gay men. And often what it is that there's an envy at the freedom that we fought for and that they take for granted. But we also have to realize there's another generation older than us that went through things we can't even imagine, and we should be grateful. And sometimes in the internet you see, I'm referred to as a queer elder, which is an honor, but I just hadn't thought of myself that way yet. And I have to prepare for that. That's where I'm going. And there is some respect, but then there's often a frustration. For instance, that in my generation, we often think of ourselves as not being people of privilege because we lived through the AIDS pandemic and getting beat up and no one being out. And yet we have now, if we look at ourselves, we actually are creatures of privilege. And it is hard to make that shift, I think, a lot, and see what we need to change inside and also let other people into the rights that we have fought for and won, and not just bring the ladder up and say, like, all right, we're going to Fire Island. That's it.
Mm-hmm. I mean, when you started writing this character, Arthur, he was older than you, and you've gotten older and closer in age to him. Do you relate to him differently?
I definitely do. Although he clearly, even the way I'm dressed today, I look exactly like the cover art.
Oh my God, you absolutely do.
Which I just did by accident.
And this is absurd.
Amazing. I definitely give him stories from my life and my deepest humiliations, and the story of his first kiss is exactly what my first kiss was like. But I don't think of him as me, because now I'm older than him. And I look at him more like a cousin of some kind who is more innocent than I and sweeter, but also blind and clumsy and causing pain to other people. And that's a nice position to be in as a novelist, because I have enough distance to deal with him as a different person. And I think I'd be more cruel to myself than I'm pretty cruel to him, I have to say. I put him in a hurricane.
You put him through a lot, but it's not punishing. It's loving, it's indulgent, it's all of these things. But his haplessness and Freddie's voice are the real engines of this book for me. I don't know if you've been paying attention to the sort of churning conversations. I mean, these conversations aren't new, but they seem to be picking up again in terms of queer literature about how to balance trauma and joy, right?
Yeah.
And what is the role of the novelist? What is the role of the novel in telling these stories? What is the truthful account? Is it the account that is sort of unsparing and full of the pain? Or, you know, what does that leave out? Does that leave out stories of lightness and love and everything else? So, I mean, I'm wondering, like, are such concerns in the room with you when you sit down and write?
I think I'm abstractly aware of that, but that I know for certain that my project for myself is to try to think of traumatic things and of my story, really, and make them a funny story. Because not just because that would be fun, but also to, it's only funny if you realize the person turned out okay. They're over it. They've transformed it. And because for me, what's often left out of queer fiction, or at least when I was a teenager in the, you know, it was like the 80s and 90s, was what I found was that always the tool was a defiant sense of joy. You know, we were out on the streets protesting the war, but the signs would say, you know, fishnets, not fighter jets, U.S. out of the war. We were funnier than they were. And that was our tool. We were always going to be funnier than the Defense Department. And we'd win the media. And that was like a revolution in protests. It's always been a sort of a tactic, and I think a really successful one. I'm not witty and cruel. I think that it could go that way. But I think just to say, like, it doesn't matter. Life's full of joy anyway. And I always felt that. And I wanted that to be in the book.
I mean, another tactic that's in the book is Arthur does think about and encounters all kinds of stories and stories of pain and stories of difficulty, especially as he's traveling. But it's not explicitly political. You don't identify, you don't sort of, for example, I mean, I think I was reading this somewhere, like we don't see like MAGA hats, you know, we don't see anything identified quite so literally and explicitly. Tell me about your decision to sort of not take that tack, which it could have been very easily, right? To go and lampoon certain people and make it very, very, you know, explicit. But you don't do that. Tell me about how you decided to handle this part of the story.
Well, I think two things. One, I think that's well covered. There's plenty of that. You know, I think that the late night shows do already an excellent job, and there's of lampooning something terrifying that's happening in the country. But I think it's also a very personal thing, which is that I'm actually not good in the mode of anger or rant or rage. And so that comes through in the book, because there's books that you need, that you write for right now. Let's read it right now. It's about right now. And then there's books where I'm thinking, I hope you could read this 10 years from now and that it would still be relevant. And if I put something that's about right now, it will have changed already. I mean, just even writing the book, everything has changed under me. But I didn't have to change the book because I didn't nail it down.
There's a way that as I was reading this, I was like, this book is trying to prepare me for things. I had this funny feeling, and I was like, what is it preparing me for? And then there's that conversation between Arthur and the wife of his lover after his lover has died, his ex-lover long ago, you know, and they're talking about the death of the ex, and someone says, oh, you know, it's shocking. And Arthur goes, no, it's not shocking. I knew it was coming. I just didn't prepare myself properly. You know, and there's a sense of the way that you talk so much. I mean, you talk, but through Arthur, so many characters in this book keep talking about attention, pay attention, look at things, you know, don't become blasé to beauty and to kindness. Tell me a little bit about about your relationship with the idea of attention, and then this book's preoccupation with attention as a certain kind of ethical position, as a moral imperative, attention, no?
That's exactly what I think. And it's what I tell my students. If you want to be an artist of some kind, or even just an ethical person, it means being vulnerable to the world. But it also means being open to a place where you didn't see beauty or variety or specificity of... I mean, I read every graffiti in every bathroom I go to, because it's just... I read the name of the you know, air freshener, because it's just... It makes it a real place I went to, not for a story of any kind, but just so that I'm actually in the world and I see that humans were here before me, and some person in a corporation chose the name Old Linen as their air freshener spray for some reason, and I just try to think about that person.
Arthur thinks a lot about you. You think a lot about this person. You're there reading bathroom graffiti. You're awake to all the delights and absurdities of life. Arthur is thinking a little bit about his career. Right? And Arthur's feeling a little bit about what does it mean to be at midlife, his position in the world. And he thinks a great deal about success. I mean, and it's a wonderful send-up of what it means to think about success, what it means to be a writer. And I'm wondering how you think about success and how, whether or not you're defining it differently, you know, having written about Arthur, having had the incredible success of Less and now of this book, has it changed for you how you define what it means to be a writerly success?
The response I got to Less, first of all, no one expected me to win that Pulitzer Prize. And then no one expected that to be a bestseller in the way it was. And having had 5 books before that, I know what's normal. I didn't come into it and be like, well, I'm a genius. I was like, I'm the same writer I was for 5 books.
Yeah, yeah,
and something different happened here that is definitely part chance, you know. Mm. That is chance. And so success can't be being lucky. Like that doesn't make any sense. Success has to be, this is a corny thing to say, reaching readers that you hadn't been able to reach before. That feels like success to me, because I know things go up and down. You know, I've seen it all. So if I'm defining success as the New York Times bestseller list, I'm setting myself up for a lot of problems. But if my success is that it reaches those other people, and I know also for every writer, there's the private success of having made the thing that was in your head. And if you can do that, the other things are not as important to you. You're like, well, I did my job. You know, the world either does their job or they don't.
Is this the end of the road for Arthur and you? Or is there another installment?
There's not immediately an installment, but I feel I have it's such a great voice for me to write in if I'm going through something that I can't find another way to get at it. But I'm not writing another Arthur Less novel at the moment. I can't imagine where he'd go now. Antarctica? Doesn't sound like a fun novel.
I don't think he has a lot of fun. I think it's...
That is true. It doesn't matter where he goes, I suppose.
he takes Arthur with himself everywhere he goes.
That's staff writer Parle Sagel talking with Andrew Sean Greer, author of the novel Less and its sequel, Less is Lost.
Since WNYC's first broadcast in 1924, we've been dedicated to creating the kind of content we know the world needs. Since then, New York Public Radio's rigorous journalism has gone on to win a Peabody Award and a DuPont Columbia Award, among others. In addition to this award-winning reporting, your sponsorship also supports inspiring storytelling and extraordinary music that is free and accessible to all. To get in touch and find out more, visit sponsorship.wnyc.org.